Commander Rappard, Reel 30. Now, so how long was the ship in dry dock at Singapore?
I can't remember, not very long, because we were getting ready for the next cruise, which was up towards the Philippines and Korea in 1960. We had a pretty exciting time, because going up to Korea, I was given a lift up to the Injin River, where the two sides from the Korean War were still facing each other across barbed wire and so on, in the demilitarized zone, which was called the ROK, R-O-K, front line. I can't remember what ROK stood for, but it was the enemy. And we were escorted around there through all the sandbagged emplacements, people manning their guns, waiting for the North Koreans to attack again. And the Americans were manning it, as well as the South Koreans. And they had a reconnaissance squadron of the 8th Cavalry, which had a simply huge sign saying how marvelous they were and what they were doing. And when we actually got to Panmunjom, I found that they were still having the truce meetings across the table in Panmunjom, where the North Koreans came in from a door on the north side of the building, and the South Koreans came in from the south side of the building, and there was a line across the middle of the table with the flags of absolutely everybody, and that line was the DMZ, as the Americans called it. The Demilitarized Zone was delineated by it. They referred to it as the treaty table, although there was, in fact, no treaty except to stop shooting each other at the time. And the communists were insisting that their actual frontier ran along the center of the table, and therefore they would not talk to anybody unless the microphone and the flags were exactly aligned along that line across the table. No negotiation was possible without that. When one went out into the camouflaged areas, one found that there were huge sand tables which delineated the actual ground all for miles around. And in the American division's forward observation post, they were taking great heed of absolutely everything that moved every day, every hour of the day and night, as far as they could. And we were flown up there in those huge Chinook helicopters with two great propellers on the top. I find it very alarming because they were so noisy, and I wasn't used to the idea of flying in helicopters except a single engine helicopter over the sea or over a ship. But deeply interesting, and quite obviously ready for war at any moment that you like to push the button. After Korea, we went down to the Philippines, which was the base of the 7th Fleet, American 7th Fleet. Because we had the flagship, there was a great deal of entertaining, and I gave a guest night party and invited some of the Americans to come. And the Major of Royal Marines, who was also in my ship, asked his opposite number for the American flagship to come. And he was one of these chaps who shaved his hair and looked sort of half naked and stood rigidly to attention at the drop of a hat. And it was explained to him what a guest night was all about, and the English drink this sort of drink beforehand and do have a glass of sherry, or some people have gin. He said he'd have both. And by the time we got halfway through the dinner, I had a vivid picture a few places away from me of my Major of Marines leading this chap into considerable problems, to say the least of it. So when we had had our glass of port and we'd drunk the toast, the loyal toast, without standing up, which struck him, it had to be explained to him, and increasingly loud voices explained to him what it was all about. He was asked if he would like a liqueur, and he didn't know what a liqueur was, but he worked it out when they spelt it for him. Ah, he said, it's liquor. Yeah, I like liquor. So I watched my Major of Royal Marines let him sample about four different liqueurs. With the inevitable result, he passed out. He passed out with such good effect, we had to keep him for 3 days under the doctor while he recovered. And eventually he had to be helped over the side and sent back to his flagship, where he no doubt got into the most awful trouble. But my Major of Marines was simply delighted because it had proved that everything that you see in the films about the American Marines is not necessarily true. However, on the way, on this marvellous trip, we did visit Hong Kong again, which was lovely, because I was playing tennis there occasionally, up on the peak. And this was the occasion when I made the visit, which I think I may have mentioned to you, to the side party lady.
Yes.
However, from there we went up to Japan, and the visit to Tokyo was remarkable in several ways, mostly for the experiences I had personally at the hands of the Japanese, but rather sort of upmarket Japanese. And we were there possibly by plans, possibly not, nobody told us, but we coincided with there being major riots in Tokyo against an impending visit of President Eisenhower. And rent a crowd in very large numbers, like 200,000 or thereabouts, had been imported from the outer islands, and they were causing mayhem in the capital. I went to a cocktail party in the British ambassador's house, the embassy, on the first night, and met the most charming Japanese girl there, who was wearing traditional Japanese dress, and she spoke perfect English, and so it was easy to find out about it. And I discovered that she was the daughter of the master of ceremonies of the imperial household. Well, by chance, Peggy's grandfather had been in Japan in the last century, last but one century, the 19th century, and had been one of the very, very few Europeans, and I think probably the only Englishman at that time, who spoke fluent Japanese. And among other things, he had been involved with a troop of lancers, our lancers, who were attacked by a party of Japanese who were against the Emperor's party. And he killed one of the attackers with his revolver and badly damaged another one. And I knew that this had been a great event in the family, so I mentioned it in passing to this girl at the embassy party. Whereupon she said, "Oh, I know about that story. It is passed down in court circles that this was the Englishman who spoke Japanese and who was the very first Englishman ever to meet the emperor." Because shooting somebody against the emperor's party led him to be brought into the emperor eventually. It was a grisly story too, because the man whom he'd only wounded was nursed back to life so that he could save the family estates by committing harakiri. That nasty business where you have to slice your insides up with your own sword in order to kill yourself, and to do it ritually without complaining. And as a great honor, my wife's grandfather had been invited to witness this event. And because I was in some way related distantly to this man, I was invited to the palace. And would I bring two friends? Well, being a tactful fellow, I asked my captain and my admiral. And it so happened that we were invited on the day when there were a vast number of rioters in the city, and the girl came to pick me up in a car or taxi or something. The captain and the admiral went in an embassy car, and we were to meet at the palace. And as my car was driving past the Houses of Parliament, the crowds dragged a member of Parliament out and murdered him on the steps of Parliament, just not terribly far away. And it was difficult for the car to get through the riots in the streets, which were full of people shouting and dancing and screaming and so on. And one of the groups who appeared to have been associated with the murder a few hundred yards away came over and stopped the car in front of ours and turned it over and set it on fire. And there was a white man in the car, Then the same group descended on Aka and wrenched the door open, were making their faces at me in terrible noises. And I was pretty badly frightened, as you'd imagine. The girl kept her cool entirely and absolutely and said something in Japanese, which changed the faces of those who heard it so that they bowed deeply and gave us an escort of 100 men to get us through the riot. And when I got my breath back, I said, "What on earth did you say to that man?" "Oh, I explained that you were English, not American," she said. And this took me back to schoolboy times when Kivas Romanus Sum was the thing which kept on going in the Roman Empire. However, it was an exciting time, not least because when we got there, we were shown the gardens. The emperor had his own personal quarters bombed to bits by the Japanese, so the family was living in the library. In this huge place in the middle of Tokyo, with a moat around it and granite blocks up the side and trees filled with ibis birds all the way around, a 100-acre site. And the gardens were superb, and the work being done by the gardeners was interesting, and we were being shown it. And I went to look at a man who was snipping the roots of a tree which was being dwarfed, one of these bonsai trees. And it was beautiful work, very carefully done with a pair of scissors. But I was breathing over his shoulder when the man who was there leading me around came and tapped me on the shoulder and beckoned me away. And I started to say, what's the matter? When he put his fingers up to his mouth and hushed me and beckoned me away, and I went to the other side of the room with him and said, "No, I must insist. If I've done something wrong, I apologize, but do tell me what it is." So peering with great fear, this other chap, he said, "You see that man?" And I said, "Yes, the gardener in the green baize apron. Yes, he's doing wonderful work." I thought he was admiring it. So, "That gardener, he is the emperor." So it was a great excitement to, by chance, to have met, or rather breathed down the neck of, the emperor. At the same time, we had certain other excitements, because we'd been to Kobe, first of all, before we went down to the capital in Tokyo. And up in Kobe, which was not far away from the Takarazuka Theatre, which was the all-women theatre, where they were putting on plays, some of which were modern American musicals and some of which were traditional Japanese plays put on by all women. And we were the guests of honor. There were two or three of the commanders were brought up there, and the lieutenant commanders were brought up there. And I was taken round the back to meet all these ladies at half time by our Japanese escort. And it was so brilliant because the girls were sent from their villages all over Japan as a great honor to take part in this training when they were really quite young, 9, 10, 11, 12. And they then stayed with it until they either succeeded or had a part, whereupon their whole village would come down and book a block in the theater and cheer them to the echo every time they came on stage. And the singers, to make themselves heard above all this noise, had what to me was something of a first. They had microphones which broadcast their voices by radio into the amplifiers so they could compete with the screams of joy from their villagers who'd come down to cheer them on. Again, a most interesting going on altogether. And I was, I see with great interest, cordially invited to a nightclub and casino for the celebration of my arrival in Kobe. That was the very first time that I had a Japanese bath, too. I took all my commanders to the local bathhouse, which had been recommended, and we went into a sort of bar where we were offered drinks and charming conversation, people who didn't speak much English. And there were sort of 15 or 20 girls in their late teens, early 20s, sitting very quietly, saying nothing at all around the outside. And we were invited to choose one to go and have a bath with. And I didn't know what the drill was at all and found this slightly anxious-making. But eventually I was taken away by a little girl, I don't know how old she was, by 18, 22, that sort of age. And she led me to her particular bathing place, where we were put on to the tatami mats. Of course, the Western end of the thing ended when you left the bar. And I had to take my shoes off, because I wasn't allowed to walk on the tatamis at all. And then I was undressed, and all my clothes were hung up, and I was put into a steam box, where I sat on a little tripod wooden stool, rather like a milking stool, and was totally shut in, even to the extent that I couldn't stand up, because just my head was sticking out. And the steam was turned on, and inside 10 minutes, I was going rather like a prawn. I was going pink all over. And I said, no, I want you to come out. And she didn't speak any English. And she was in the other side of the room pouring water into a bath and doing something with the towels on a massage couch and so on. And eventually I started to kick the floor of this thing, kick the sides of it. And so she came over and inquired and put her hand on my forehead, waved a finger at me and shook her head, and in effect was saying I wasn't quite cooked yet, and left me in there a little longer. Well, by the time I did get out of this damn bath, steam bath, I was really a bit rocky, to say the least of it. So I made a beeline for the bath, and so she grabbed me by the hand and pointed to the wooden stool she'd brought out, which was well short of the bath, and made me sit on this wooden stool, which was about a foot high. There's nothing more undignified when you're totally stark naked and sitting on a wooden stool that high with a totally strange young woman. So I wondered what was going to happen next, but I didn't wonder for long, because she produced soap and a sponge and started to bath me all over. But all over. And only then, when she'd poured a couple of buckets of water over me, was I allowed to get into the bath, because it was made clear that getting into the bath would be filthy if I got in with my own dirt still on me. So in the bath, I was allowed to soak for a while, and eventually, feeling a little bit weak, I must admit, by then, I was taken out of the bath, and towels were provided, and I dried off, whereupon I was laid out on the massage couch, with a towel decorously across my middle. And she proceeded to massage me in a way I had never been massaged before in my life, by walking up and down my body. And I thought I was still reasonably fit for a commander at that age, but if you have a lady walking up your back and letting her feet slide sideways from your backbone down to the side, you eventually get pinched, because a large piece of your tummy gets caught between her feet and the bed. Well, by the time I'd finished and got dressed again and went back to the place where we were offered another drink, I was feeling immensely clean, somewhat shattered, and very tired indeed. And I found that all the other commanders were just as tired as I was. But it was an extraordinary experience. Quite amazing. In the Japanese area, because of this girl having been educated, the girl who was the daughter of the Master of Ceremonies of the Imperial Household, and had been educated both in the Western fashion and in the Japanese fashion, she taught me the significance of the angle of a flower. And she took me out to see the sand and rock gardens, which were admired across the whole of Japan, and indeed across the whole world. One of them was 600 years old and was called a stone garden. And one had to sit contemplating the stone garden and the ripples made in the sand and the angles of them for anything up to an hour to appreciate the beauty of them. And I find this very difficult, because I'm not naturally artistic. And we went to the Heian Shrine, where I very nearly made the most awful gaffe by walking into it in my shoes, as opposed to leaving my shoes at the bottom. I was totally overtaken, in fact, by the way in which it was done. Now, because we'd been had a couple of other stops to make, we moved up to where the imperial china had been made for the emperors for several hundred years. And we were invited also to go and see cultivated pearls in the production process. cultivated pearls, so it was an explanation designed for tourists in several languages, so one could understand how these things were done, with the oysters hanging in baskets below barges in the sea inlets. And it was explained to us that pearls of this colour were more valuable than pearls of that colour, and there were black pearls and all the rest of it. And eventually, having been told the value of these things, we were taken into a room with a dining room table, very much like this one, except that there was a mound of pearls on it. And we were told that we could have a pearl each. Well, seeing the officer's eyes immediately turn into pound signs, having just been taught the value of the pearls, we scrabbled around in this, and we all collected our one pearl before realizing that one pearl by itself is virtually useless anyway. So we all pocketed our pearl. Mine's disappeared since then, and sadly that went. But in the China place, the headman, the chairman of it, and his son and his daughter-in-law and his wife entertained us to dinner after we had been ushered into the boardroom, a sort of westernized boardroom, where we were each given a brand new set of bamboo brushes and a set of paints, and invited to give free flow to the brilliant artistic talent which so many Englishmen always had, which was absolutely great, except that yours truly had absolutely no artistic talent at all. And I watched one or two of my friends drawing pretty pictures of boats sailing or whatever it was. And the only thing I could think of to do was to copy the sign which indicated that it was that particular factory called Arita, and to try and draw a picture of a traditionally dressed Japanese gentleman, which appeared. And after half an hour of appalling embarrassment for me and rather fun for anybody who could draw, we were told that we were now going to be taken out and shown the production, and we watched the way everybody was making these plates and saucers of every sort under the sun. And then we were swept off to lunch with the great man in his home. Well, he said in beautifully modulated English that his command of our interesting and beautiful language was insufficient to enable him to sit with us, and therefore he would leave our entertainment to his daughter and his daughter-in-law and his son. The admiral was on this party, and indeed my captain. And when we'd finished, when we were about to have lunch, we found that the daughter and the wife were serving us on their knees, kneeling down in front of each one of us to help ourselves to food, kneeling on the tatami mats again. And it was a jolly good lunch, but I haven't the foggiest idea what we ate now. And afterwards, the admiral was asked, did he play golf? And so the admiral said, yes, he played a bit of golf. Oh, it would be particular honour for the household if we could drive one or two golf balls off. So we all went to the French windows, out into the garden, and out into the garden we duly went, and 60 yards in one direction there was a forest, and 60 yards in the other direction were the roofs of the village. And the admiral clearly was at a loss as to whether he was to drive the balls over the village or what. He said, oh, it was considered as particularly good luck if we could drive a golf ball between the crotch of that tree, and there was a tree on the edge of the forest. So we drove a couple of hundred golf balls into the forest. People disappeared, I suppose, to pick them up afterwards. And we went off somewhere else. A couple of days later, the plate that I had been decorating was returned to me, glazed and fired. And there it is on your right-hand side. But to make quite certain...
So you just point out it's dated 22nd of June 1960.
That's right. So that if we'd said what we really enjoyed more than anything else was smashing china, that we'd have been offered the choice of about six hammers and told to get on with it. It was a most amazing hospitality all the way around, in fact. One way and another, we'd been out there quite a long time by the autumn of 1960, and the time had come for us to have a proper by the cleaning and all the rest of it in dry dock. And my wife, Peggy, came out from England in a flight which took really quite a long time, one way or another.
Where was the boiler cleaning carried out?
Singapore again, where we were based. And so Peggy and I went on holiday up in Penang. And we stayed both in one of the hill houses, 6,000 feet, on the way, and also with one of the rubber planters who had been on the death list for the terrorists. One of the motorcycle terrorist people had had his head cut off, I think, by running into a wire stretched along one of the paths. And they'd found on him a list of the people to be murdered, and this chap was on the list. By the time we got there, that particular terrorism had reduced a lot, and we were liaising closely as a ship with the 10th Gurkhas, who were based up there. However, we had this party with the planters, which was remarkable in itself, because they apparently had a monthly meeting at a particular town, about 30 miles drive away from where this particular chap had his rubber plantation. And we drove over there with his charming Scottish wife. And when we got into the party, the planters drank in the next 45 minutes what I would have regarded enough to knock a horse out cold. And they appeared to be at the peak of their form within the hour. And I thought they'd all be flat on their backs within 2 or 3 hours. But it wasn't so. They just went on drinking and it didn't have any more effect. But the time came when we had to start back about midnight. And my chap's eyesight, I think, was impaired, would be a good way of describing it, because he kept on the road, which wasn't lit anyway, by going sort of port five on the helm till he hit the left-hand verge, and then starboard five till he hit the right-hand verge, which was one way of proceeding. It wasn't very quick, but it seemed safer than any other alternative. And I was sitting beside him in the front, and Peggy was very worried about what was going on sitting on the back seat. And I became more and more worried because I remember there was a Bailey Bridge over a river and we were approaching it doing this zigzag from side to side. And as we got towards the rise to the bridge, the chap drove more and more slowly until we got to the very top of the bridge when he stopped in the pitch black of the middle of the night, waved his arm out of the window and said, "Lovely view." And we really couldn't see the side of the bridge, let alone whether there's a view or not. Well, at 4:30, 4:45 in the morning, I was called, because I said I'd like to get up when he got up to see the tappers. And he appeared to be totally stone-cold sober, and directing the tappers in their work of which bits of the plantation to tap the rubber from. And I was not surprised to find they normally retired at about 50 years old and came back to live in their pensions in seaside resorts in England. But it was a very remarkable insight as to what it was like. And Peggy and I stayed up in Penang, as it happened, which was the most marvellous place to go. But one of the curious things we saw on the way up was a snake temple at Port Dickson. And the local Buddhists worshipped snakes. And there were snakes in hundreds all over the floor of the temple with the worshippers in and out, and us with great anxiety trying not to tread on a cobra or something. And the incense, which the monks in the church was burning all the time, apparently made the snakes soporific. And we were staying in a hotel in Port Dickson where we asked if we could buy the little notice in English, which struck us as being slightly unusual from any hotel we'd been in before, because it told us that the bringing in of ladies was not permitted. And you'll see that below when you go out there, that particular one. Well, by the time we got to New Year's Day 1961, I only had about another month to go, and I had begun to meet some very interesting Chinamen, two brothers who had cornered the movie industry in the Far East.